The Guardian.
Hello, this is Science Weekly for May the 5th. I'm Alok Jha. Coming up on this week's show, what can the climate of the past tell us about the future? Chris Turney, author of a new book on climate change, is in the pod to help us decipher the messages from extreme weather events in the Earth's history. Also in the podcast...
There is only one question. The universe with a big question mark after that word. Its origin, its destination, its structure, and all the details which are components of the universe.
We talked to Michael Heller. He's a priest and the latest winner of the controversial Templeton Prize. And has someone really invented a powder that makes fingers grow back? Well, of course not, but we'll dissect another media calamity, the dodgy story of pixie dust. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. Now, we've not got producer Ben this week, so there aren't any terrible jokes, fortunately. I'll just get on with introducing the team. James Randerson is The Guardian's angriest science correspondent. Hello, James.
There aren't very many of us left now.
Well, it's true. It's all secret. And I'm honoured to be welcoming Riazat Butt, The Guardian's religious affairs ninja. Hello there.
Hello, Alok.
How does it feel to be on a science podcast?
I'm very excited.
I know. You've done loads of work on this as well. I'm really pleased that you're here. It's great. Our guest this week is Chris Turney. He's a professor of physical geography at the University of Exeter, where he researches past climate change and what it means for the future. That's also the subject of his new book, Ice, Mud and Blood. Chris, welcome to the pod.
Hi, Alok.
Your book, as we just said, is about past climate change. Now, we'll talk about current climate change in a moment, but what can the past tell us about what's happening to the world now?
Yeah, we can learn a lot from the past, actually. It's one of these things that you tend to think, oh, the past is just a sort of historical or geological quirk, and really it's just the here and now that's important. So we can go back to geological records, and we get a real handle on why the environmental changes, the climate changes we're seeing today are so exceptional.
The idea of climate change clearly isn't a new one. I mean, what kinds of examples of climate change have there been in the Earth's past? I mean, 4 billion years, there must have been all sorts of things.
Oh, it's full of weird, wacky examples going all the way back to the past. A great example, if you go back just a mere 55 million years ago, we had this huge cataclysm. Vast amounts of greenhouse gases were dumped up into the atmosphere, and as a result of which, global temperatures rose 5 to 9 degrees centigrade. So that's a really extreme. At the other end of the scale, you can go back even further, hundreds of millions of years ago, and potentially the whole world was covered in ice. So the world naturally goes from one extreme to the other. It's just a question mark is why this is particularly exceptional, what we're seeing today. And what we can do is, by looking in the past, we have a good idea of what drove those changes.
Are any of the previous climate changes similar to anything that we're experiencing now, in terms of the temperatures or the speed or anything like that?
Yeah, the rate of change that we're seeing at the moment is pretty exceptional, actually. Obviously, in the past, virtually all the changes that happened weren't driven by people, but we can learn a lot from the mechanisms of them. So, I mean, there's some great examples. If you go back 130,000 years ago, just because of the way the Earth orbited the Sun, it's the last interglacial, the world was on average about 1 degree centigrade warmer. It got a lot more heat from the Sun. But that 1 degree centigrade equaled about 5 to 6 in the Arctic, and a large part of Greenland ice melted, and the world's sea levels were about 4 to 6 meters higher.
You said there about how the Earth orbiting the Sun can change the climate. What other reasons are there for these sudden changes? I mean, how does it happen?
This is one of the big things, really, is there's a difference between gradual change and very abrupt change. So you can get very gradual changes driven by the Earth's orbit around the Sun is one example, but you can get quite abrupt change. Big changes in volcanic eruptions is a great example. You might have heard of the Indonesian volcano Tambora. Now, that erupted in 1815. It sent a huge amount of ash up into the atmosphere, cooled the world temperatures by about 1 degree centigrade. It led the year following to sort of the year without a summer, they called it in America. Climates changed. It became far more miserable. A bushel of wheat in America jumped up to $2.50 in price, and that wasn't repeated until 1972. Conditions are so miserable. Mary Shelley knocked out Frankenstein, and Lord Byron wrote Darkness. So it was quite inspirational to some people. So climatic conditions can suddenly change. But the big thing, certainly in the North Atlantic, is this idea that warm waters brought up from the tropics, the so-called Gulf Stream.
James, you've got a question.
The whole field now has become, incredibly kind of politically charged with a small army of climate sceptics poring over past climate data, trying to pick holes in the idea that, we're causing global warming. And one of the chestnuts that is often repeated, and I just be interested to know your thoughts on it and, what you think, basically, is this idea that actually what happens is, rather than CO2 leading to an increase in temperature, what happens is actually that temperatures increase and then CO2 increases in the record. Is there any truth in that?
Yeah, there is actually truth in that. It's often been twisted, as these things usually are. That's a great example. If you go back into the ice cores, you can go back, you can drill these kilometre-long ice cores in Antarctica, and you can extract from the gas bubbles carbon dioxide and methane, all these other greenhouse gases. And what you often see is because of these changes in the Earth's orbit around the sun, you do get increases in these greenhouse gases that come on afterwards. The worrying thing is that when you look in the past and you see that these changes happen afterwards, what it shows is that the carbon cycle of the Earth is being amplified by these climate changes. And so when people have taken what we see in the past and taken that forward into the future, it shows that the world's climate is actually far more sensitive to greenhouse gases than we thought. And so it could potentially get up to 6 degrees centigrade warmer for a doubling of carbon dioxide. So actually, although it sounds like it's a cop-out and, oh, actually, we don't need to worry, in fact, actually, it shows it's even more worrying than we'd like to admit.
Chris, let me play devil's advocate for a moment here. Mm. Your book kind of says that over the past history of the Earth, there's been all these sorts of changes all naturally happening. I mean, we weren't driving cars a million years ago. So for those people who are climate deniers who say, look, actually, this is just a natural cycle, what's going on now, if they read your book, will they get ammunition?
No, I don't think at all, actually. Really, what I wanted to try and explain was, well, partially to show some for fun things you can learn from the past, but also just to explain what actually drove those changes. So you might have heard of things like the Little Ice Age, when Arctic ice came down south. There's examples of Inuit landing in Scotland because they'd follow the pack ice and come too far south, so-called frost fairs in London on the Thames. And then during the medieval warm period, you'd have things like vineyards quite far north and the French complaining about how the vineyards were out-competing them. Great times, but we know principally what the causes of those changes were. Volcanic eruptions, what the sun was doing and the like. But the key thing what we can learn from that is that when you plug those controls from the past and try to understand what's happening at the moment, you can't explain the recent warming.
Chris, I just wanted to ask you, what are the dangers of climate change becoming a fad? It seems that certainly for the last couple of years, it's being dropped into campaigns and sentences and advertising and company policies. So, I mean, do you think that climate change is a fashion? Do you think it's something that can engage the public's interest? Because that's really what needs to happen.
Absolutely. I mean, there's very much a groundswell at the moment. There's a lot of public support. Let's do something about this. The danger is that it is driven largely by emotive factors. People are quite enthusiastic because of polar bears and all the like. And that's
will
a real...
Will polar bears die?
Well, some will,
I like
definitely.
Polar bears. No,
my daughter would agree with you. I shouldn't be laughing, should I? It's not funny
at
all.
No, not when they're going to die.
No, not at all. Sorry.
It's okay.
Black armband on.
Okay.
But the worry is that it is because it's emotive. There is an element that's quite fashionable to do something about it. And that was one of the reasons why I wrote the book, really, because I wanted to explain the science so people can understand it. We desperately need to make a lot of changes at the moment. And unless people understand the science, they're not going to do it. And then they might end up going on to something else. So hopefully by explaining the science, people get a better handle on what's involved.
Chris, we'll come back to your motivations for the book a bit later in the show. But can I just wind this bit up by asking you, what happens to life during all these sudden changes in climate? I mean, if the Earth's temperature drops by a huge amount and there's ice everywhere, not everything will survive. And then again, if it warms, not everything will survive. What does the Earth do with all of its life forms during all this time?
Yeah, it's a good question, actually. And to be perfectly honest, there's no actual unambiguous answer. Sometimes people have argued that big warmings and coolings have caused extinctions. But there's a huge debate. One of the largest was at the end of the last ice age, especially in North America. And it was whether it was climate change or whether it was people. So we're still wrestling with that at the moment. But anything where you get a big climate change, it puts a stress on the population and they're going to struggle, really.
I heard climate scientists say that if we don't get on top of this problem, that the Earth will survive anyway. It might get a few degrees warm, but it'll just kill most of us because we can't survive in that sort of temperature. The Earth will just get rid of us like a sneeze or something.
Well, yeah, I guess there'll be a lot less of us anyway.
Chris, well, thank you for that for now. We'll hear more from you a bit later. You can read more on this topic at guardian.co.uk/science and guardian.co.uk/environment. I'm Alok Jha. You're listening to Science Weekly from The Guardian. Still to come, why living in a tree-lined street might prevent asthma. Plus, Riazet here gets all starstruck on her visit to Claridge's to interview Michael Heller, though the hotel's luggage porter is a bit less impressed.
I've just seen John Malkovich. Should I be excited or are there more glamorous people inside?
To me, they're just human beings, but nice people, but we're all famous in our own right.
There's somebody else who's really famous inside the building. Have you ever heard of a guy called Michael Heller?
No, I haven't, actually.
He's a cosmologist, so he studies the universe. Okay. And he's a priest, and he's just won £820,000.
He's a very lucky man.
Are you impressed?
Yeah, sort of, but it takes a lot to impress me.
He's not impressed.
That does impress him.
That's all coming up. But first, here's a pick of the other science stories making headlines over the past 7 days. This is Riazat and James with your News Jam.
News Jam.
Global warming is set to stall over the next 10 years as natural variations in ocean currents counteract man-made climate change. Models of the European and North American climates found that a major ocean current that brings warm water northwards is set to weaken, potentially offsetting temperature rises caused by human activity. Scientists believe the meridional overturning current strengthens and weakens on a natural cycle with a 70 to 80 year period.
A hormone used in contraceptive pills may help prevent brain damage in people who suffer serious head injuries. Doctors believe injections of progesterone can promote the survival of nerve cells in the aftermath of a severe injury. In a trial of 159 patients who had serious brain injuries, doctors reported that only 18% of those given progesterone died of their injuries, compared with 32% of the placebo group.
Some of Britain's most prestigious science facilities are at risk of closure due to poor management of public research funds, MPs said last week. The criticism was directed at the leadership of the Science and Technology Facilities Council, which is dealing with an £80 million shortfall in funds. The lack of cash has led to widely criticised cuts to the council's programme, leaving university physics departments in fear of closure and British science facilities such as the Daresbury Laboratory and Jodrell Bank Observatory in Cheshire under threat.
And finally, living on a tree-lined street reduces a child's risk of developing asthma compared with life in a grey inner-city neighbourhood. Scientists found that asthma rates among 4 to 5-year-olds fell by almost a quarter for every 343 extra trees per square kilometre in an urban area. Asthma has increased by around 160% globally in the last 2 decades, although scientists are not sure what is causing this rise.
Riazat and James, thank you very much. Let's go into those a little bit more. That first story, Chris, about the ocean currents is a good example of the kind of stuff that causes these long-term climate changes. This is the meridional overturning current. Can you tell us what that is, what that's all about?
Yeah, it's basically a circulation system, largely in the Atlantic Ocean, but basically extends all the way around the world. What happens is you get very warm waters in the tropics and they're brought further north. And as they move north, they evaporate, they give off heat, which comes downwind and makes us such a balmy, warm country. But as of course, the water...
Right now, isn't it?
No, damp and miserable as normal. as it comes further north, it's giving off heat, it cools down, it becomes saltier until eventually it sinks. And while it's doing so, the winds are blowing, particularly in the low latitude, in the tropics, and that's drawing up the water that's sunk. So the whole thing goes as a conveyor belt system.
This just shows actually how complicated it is to try and predict climate even next week, never mind in 100 years or anything. But this natural cycle, what they're saying, is a 70 to 80 year cycle, and it might negate some of the warming in the next decade. I'm embarrassed to ask this, but does this mean we don't have to do anything about climate change?
No. If anything, it just shows a bit of a lifeline to give us a bit more time, really. In the Little Ice Age, it looks like this same process was happening, and it was actually a lot slower for about a few hundred years, or maybe about 10% lower than it was today. So
maybe some skating on the Thames
that's
again.
That's right. Excellent.
Yeah, it's good stuff, isn't it? James, let's move on to the asthma story. This is essentially saying that living on a tree-lined street seems to reduce a child's risk of developing asthma. Now, does this mean that I should plant lots of trees or live next to trees if I'm having kids?
This is the temptation of how to interpret these kind of epidemiological studies, but it's you always have to be very careful with these kind of studies because, I mean, that could be the interpretation. It could be something to do directly with trees. Maybe trees suck up the pollution that causes asthma. Much more likely, though, is that trees per se are a kind of proxy measure for a kind of neighbourhood where kids are less likely to get asthma. So it could be that, you know, the kind of middle-class, richer neighbourhoods are the ones which have the trees, and within those neighbourhoods you have homes which are, I don't know, have other things about them that are different from the inner-city neighbourhoods, which are what are causing the difference in asthma.
So if you're living next door to a motorway and your kids grow up with asthma, planting lots of trees around it won't make
it's
any
just
difference.
Probably not going to help, unfortunately. You
know, that's,
sorry about
that's a bit of a shame, isn't it?
If only it were that simple, we'd probably cracked it by now, I suspect.
I mean, I would have thought, actually, that living next to trees would have made your asthma worse. Surely all the pollen and
yeah,
all of that.
Yeah, imagine, yeah, maybe pollen would make a difference, but
clearly
no,
it doesn't.
Apparently not.
I just want to big up the podcast, actually, in a way. You know, I'm just really pleased to see.
We were.
I know, I'm really pleased to hear that Jodrell Bank was mentioned in Parliament, and this is the story about the Science and Technology Facilities Council. The Parliamentary Committee for University and Skills said that the whole thing was a shambles, that Jodrell Bank's a national icon. I'm pleased that they took notice after our campaign last week.
Did they mention the song?
I don't think they mentioned
the
song.
Jodrell Bank song?
That's
yeah,
right.
Indeed,
that's
indeed, yeah.
Can you sing me a few bars?
I can't remember any of it. But James was quite nasty about it last week. Do you want to...
Yeah, no, I feel a bit embarrassed about that. It's grown on me. Particularly when I saw the video, I thought the video was brilliant.
It's an excellent thing. But I'm just pleased that the country's taking notice of what we're saying on this show. And it's going to save it, I hope.
At last. The voice of reason is getting through to Parliament.
And one more thing. Before we get on to my favourite story of the week... Now, apparently computer keyboards are something like 150 times or something dirtier than loo seats, partly because people keep eating at their desks. James, do you eat at your desk?
I do, but unlike you, I don't eat on a loo seat, which is quite horrible. I've always thought that would be a really bad idea.
I just eat at your desk, because your desk stays dirty. Look, forget all that. My favourite story this week was all about how to regrow fingers. Now, I really want to believe that this story is true. James, take us through the pixie dust tale.
Okay,
from start to finish.
Okay. On Wednesday evening, this appeared on the BBC website, and this is the claim by a guy in the US, I think, was it? Who he claimed that he'd had part of his finger sliced off by a toy aeroplane and had sprinkled what he described as pixie dust, but it was actually some product made by his brother's company, which was a kind of extract of a pig's intestine, I think, supposedly, and sprinkled this on the finger over a course of several days, and the finger grew back. Now, the BBC got very excited about this, including drawing a kind of graphic of the finger sort of growing back from halfway, which was kind of grossly inaccurate. But anyway, the news desk came over to the science desk, Ian and I, and we hastily told them that it smelt very much like bullshit, and but we did start to try and check it out. Unfortunately, we couldn't get through to anyone who could be much help, but we did say, look, don't run this, it's clearly wrong.
What about the rest of our cousins on Fleet Street? What happened there? Did they ignore it too?
Well, no. A lot of them fell for it hook, line and sinker, and you know, it was on the front page of the Mail, for example. The Times and the Telegraph ran it fairly credulously. I haven't read all of those stories, but most of the coverage was kind of, you know, amazing new pixie dust grows back finger type thing. And anyway, it did transpire that, well, I mean, Ben Goldacre at the weekend had a great piece that was showing the kind of anatomy of this story. And actually, this same story has been in the news twice before. This is the third time. And, you know, apart from anything else, the amount of finger that grew back was only a tiny bit on the end, which is not that impressive anyway. I mean, it looked quite nasty, but, you know, at the end of the day, it was only a small amount of skin, really.
As he said in his piece, I mean, fingers do grow back, and it happens all the time. It's happening right now, yeah. Probably. You don't need pixie dust.
But fundamentally, there's nothing scientific about sprinkling something on a finger. I mean, you've got no control group. It's only one. You know, it's just one anecdote. I mean, the story was wrong in every possible way. It just should never have seen the light of day.
How could they have not known it was wrong? I mean, I don't know anything about science, but it just sounds so bogus. But it just sounds so stupid and unbelievable, and people fell for it.
I think it fits into
pixie dust.
Well, the thing is,
pixie dust. I mean, come on.
The phrase pixie dust was from the guy, the patient, and it was kind of his own pet nickname for the stuff, so you can kind of forgive that. It was, you know, that was just what he called it. But even so, the thing about it, I think, is it fits into that kind of story that news desks love, because it's very easy to understand. It sounds incredible, and there's a lovely visual image to go with it.
You can
draw
graphics. Yeah.
And so it kind of fits all the things that are right, and you need a, you know, you need specialist journalists to turn up and say, hang on a minute, this just isn't true.
How excited did our news desk get?
You know, they had to be talked down from the ledge, but that's we do that on a daily basis. You know, Alec will back me up on this. This is most of what our job is telling them not to run stories
before,
that are clearly.
I'm going to save James before he sacks them. Chris, last word to you on this. Do you get frustrated by this sort of incredulous reports of science, or do you think it's a bit of fun?
There's a little bit of both, really. I think the problem is urban myths, it's out there now, and most people you talk to, they'll probably believe it. So that way, it's kind of shocking. But you don't want to be a party pooper, but at the same time, now people believe you sprinkle anything on it. It's got a bit of a Monty Python feel to it, really. I don't know where it ends.
Very good. Well, we'll leave that there. To have your say on any of this stuff, you can head to the Science blog. That's blogs.guardian.co.uk/science, or post a comment on the Facebook wall. Continuing now with our everlasting theme of religion. The Templeton Prize honours a living person who has made an exceptional contribution to affirming life's spiritual dimension, whether through research, journalism, practice or scholarship. Previous winners include the physicist Freeman Dyson and the philosopher Charles Taylor. This year it's been awarded to the Polish cosmologist and priest Michael Heller. Our religious affairs hitwoman, Riazat Butt, went to meet him. Riazat, what was this guy like?
He was very benign. He was quite... As priests are, exactly. Very benign, very considered, very thoughtful, very reserved. He wasn't terribly flamboyant, but then he's a priest and he's a cosmologist, so I don't know how much he'd be out there doing crazy stuff.
Bungee jumping, that kind of thing.
He's just won £820,000. That's a lot of money. So I started by asking him what he'd done to deserve this prize money.
I just did my work for more than 30 years. Because to get a prize, that kind of prize, you must devote all your life for that. But I think that the judges of the prize selected exactly my humble person, because I am not writing and speaking about the relationship between science and theology, but I am doing real research in both these fields. And I think the judges of the Templeton Prize, well, took that as a kind of decisive thing. That's my guess, of course.
And what will you do with the money? Because it's quite a large amount of money. How much is it?
It is 820,000 British pounds. So it's really a huge amount of money. And I must say, I wouldn't know what to do with that money if I had to use it for my personal purposes. So I wanted to get rid of that money as soon as possible. Well, and I gave all that money to found in Krakow, a sort of institution, scientific academic institution, which will be doing research and education in the field of natural sciences, philosophy, and also some theology, history of science as well. And it will be called Copernicus Center.
What are the biggest questions for cosmologists?
There is only one question. The universe, with a big question mark after that word. Its origin, its destination, its structure, and all the details which are components of the universe. For instance, we are talking here, and our bodies are made out of chemical elements, and chemical elements were synthesized somewhere in the past history of the universe. So we are really, products of the universe.
Is there, as the new atheists would say, a conflict between religion and science?
I would prefer to call these so-called conflict tensions, and perhaps creative tensions, because this conflict, they enriched somehow themselves with this. And this interaction could be sometimes painful, but all creative things are painful.
Is there anything that you don't like about science, and is there anything that you don't like about religion? Because you're a priest, aren't you?
Yes, I am a priest. I don't like theologians not knowing anything about sciences and scientists not knowing anything about religion. And unfortunately, this happens quite often.
Let's move on to Richard Dawkins. Now, he's been very critical about the Templeton Prize. I'm going to have to read this out in full. Richard Dawkins says, there's a prize called a Templeton Prize, which, as you know, was founded by an extremely rich man who gave his money to any scientist prepared to subvert science and betray scientific ideals. The only specification of the quantity of the Templeton Prize is that it has to be larger than the Nobel Prize in money. He also describes the prize as a very large sum of money given usually to a scientist who is prepared to say something nice about religion.
According to him, Sir John Templeton simply bribes science in order to to be more favorable to religion. I must say I don't feel bribed. I just did my science and my research in philosophy and theology as honestly as I could. And I must say a lot of money is going also to make a propaganda for atheist interpretation of science. So I think some balance is not bad, a bad thing.
I mean, he says that it goes to any scientist prepared to subvert science and betray scientific ideals. Do you think you've done that?
I never betrayed science. Once I had a possibility to discuss with Richard Dawkins many years ago, somebody asked me, because it was a little group of people, what's the difference between my views and Richard Dawkins' views? And I answered that it's the difference is a little difference in spelling. And then he was rather astonished, how is it possible? And I say, because I spell the word rationality with a capital R, and you are spelling the word rationality with a small R. What I meant is that science is discovering rationality, some rational plan which is behind the phenomena which are investigated by science. And in the religious interpretation, this rationality discovered by science is what Einstein was calling the mind of God, which God had in the act of creation. So it is a rationality with a capital R. And for him, it is just rationality without any further explanation. And his answer was, after a while of thinking, he said, "You are probably right."
I don't believe for a second that Dawkins said you're probably right to anyone.
No,
anyone
exactly.
That's incredible.
I don't think Dawkins would ever publicly admit he was wrong.
Very, very interesting interview. He's obviously someone who has thought a lot about this stuff in his career and stuff. So, you know, there's no sense in saying that he himself is, you know, corrupting science or anything like this. But just let's step back a sec. Tell us a bit about John Templeton and what the Templeton Prize is. And we can go into a bit of the controversy around this, why scientists get worked up about this.
Well, the Templeton Prize is the largest single monetary award given for absolutely anything. As we heard during the interview, it's bigger than the Nobel Prize, and it's always adjusted, so it's always bigger than the Nobel Prize, and I'll leave you to make your own minds up about that. So John Templeton was a squillionaire stockbroker. He played the markets, he made a load of cash, he sold, he made a huge fortune out of it. He set up a foundation as well, and the idea was to bring science and religion close together. So it follows that if that's the broad aim of the organisation, you will get people writing and working, not necessarily for the foundation, but they're not going to write something that says religion is a load of old pants.
The problem some scientists, I suppose, have with this organisation, and it has to be said, they give grants out too for research. It's not just this prize, there's lots of other things. I mean, the amounts of money that they have are incredible, billions or something.
Would they give me some money?
Well, they probably would if you wanted to sort of prove that science and religion are the same thing.
I was wondering whether this pod might be a potential future winner.
Well, it's brought us together.
Well, yeah, but I think we're driving a further wedge between. We'll come back to that later. But I think what scientists might have a problem with, and Chris, I'll ask you about this because you are a scientist, but the whole point of science, surely, is to come up with a hypothesis for something and then test it without any idea of what the result might be and without any sort of presumption. The whole point of anything that the Templeton organisation seems to do is to say, right, can you prove that God exists, please?
It does make you cringe, doesn't it, a little bit? Yeah, so if you go around actually trying to prove a hypothesis by actually saying that's what you're going to go and do, it's not really science, really. The only thing it does tell me is that amount of money, I'm in the wrong business, really.
The people who've won this prize before, Freeman Dyson, for example, Paul Davis, great physicists, people who, you know, have done some amazing things in very basic physics stuff. But do you think that if foundational physics stuff, the stuff that is not necessarily applicable immediately, is funded by this sort of organisation, then it will skew that particular field? I mean, because there's not huge amounts of money going in from the public, for example, for this sort of stuff. I mean, you've got the LHC, which is looking at the God particle, inverted commas. But I mean, even as we heard before, the Science and Tech Facilities Council in this country is pulling out of all sorts of foundation physics stuff. And if they have to go to organisations like Templeton, I mean, is that dangerous? Does that worry anyone?
I'm not sure. I always throw the question back. Do you think there's any evidence that it has skewed areas of physics? I mean, I think what it has perhaps done is it's sort of planted within the scientific establishment some high-profile figures who you could argue now have, you know, a motivation to be rather kind to that side of the argument.
Well, yeah, I mean,
yeah, because they've received a huge amount of money. It's quite hard for them to turn around. Exactly.
Exactly. Someone gives you some cash to go away, do some work, and then You don't want to throw it back in their face, really, do you?
But, yeah, well, quite. But you haven't got people like Paul Davies and Freeman Dyson, you know, publishing papers that say, you know, I've discovered evidence in particle physics that God exists in such a kind of crude way. So I'm not sure the evidence is there that it's sort of in a kind of material way skewed the direction of physics, if you see what I mean.
The Templeton organisation does lots of things, as we said. And one of the other ones is these seminars at Cambridge University, where it's based. They're called science religion seminars, and people like Dawkins have been to these. And a freelance journalist called John Horgan once went to this a couple of years ago and wrote about this, because he's an atheist, and he was saying, oh, you know, maybe I should go to find out what they're all up to. And he found them quite, you know, open-minded and stuff. But he did say, when he wrote about it at the end, that this is a quote from his article. He said, to demonstrate its open-mindedness, the foundation should really award the Templeton Prize to an opponent of religion, such as Steven Weinberg or Richard Dawkins. At the very least, the foundation should post this essay on its website. This is the essay that John Horgan wrote. Riaza, what do you think? Do you think that something like this would be a good idea, or would it just be a publicity stunt?
I think it might help the Templeton Foundation to prove its impartiality and neutrality and to show that it was open to all comers. And then, of course, if you're really cynical, you might just say it was a publicity stunt. So I think they're damned if they do and damned if they don't.
I suppose it's the problem of having a premise right from the start, which you're trying to prove, James.
I think this business about always being a little bit more than the Nobel Prize is quite odd. I mean, it just strikes me as willy-waving, basically. Do you know what I mean? I mean, it's just...
I was waiting for someone to say
that. We've got more money than you. You know, it's ridiculous.
Well, it's just so that they get more pretension, surely. That's clearly what it is. If it was a £50,000 prize, no one would care.
Well, yeah, no, you're absolutely right. But, I mean, you know, you'd still get a lot of attention if it was 750,000 as opposed to 820 because it's just a bit more than Nobel. Yeah, I don't know.
The Nobel Prize is a real prize, though, isn't it? Chris, final word to you. Once again, in the interview, we heard that perhaps the prize is just a way to bribe scientists. Do you think that's true?
I think everyone's got to take their own call on it, really. I mean, essentially, if you are giving money for that and it is a prize, then good luck to you, really. But at the end of the day, it's your beliefs and that's your call.
You've got to square them with your own sort of scientific ideals, I suppose, don't you?
Yes.
Right, we'll leave that there. More of all of this stuff at www.templeton.org. And I also feel compelled at this point to point you to richarddawkins.net for his choice comments on the Templeton Prize. Have a read and post your comments on our blog. Before we head out of the studio door this week, let's go back to our guest, Chris Turney. You remember he's written a book on past climate change. Chris, in the introduction to your book, you said that you came to study this subject quite late. Can you tell us why?
It's something we do day in, day out, and we all enjoy it as scientists, and it gives you a real buzz learning new stuff about the world. And what you realise is that when you then start talking about what's bread and butter to the rest of us out in the public and you just chat to your friends and family, it's amazing stuff that you take for granted just isn't out there. I mean, I was an example when they have a great global warming swindle, and that was broadcast in Australia, and I was over there in the audience. And
this was Martin Durkin's film.
This was the fun one, that's right,
that,
yes.
That's showing that perhaps global warming's all lies.
Full of wonderful howlers, it was great. But it was broadcast in Australia, and I was invited along, and I went in the audience, and I was just suddenly aware that when all this rubbish was being spouted, I was sitting there thinking, oh, God, this is dreadful. And suddenly noticed that most of the audience around me were nodding and sort of quietly agreeing with it. And I was quite shocked, actually. So I was coming towards the end of writing a book at the time, and I thought, oh, this is another example where you think most of the stuff is out there. Climate change is talked about all the time. And I just wonder sometimes how much people really do understand climate change.
We were talking earlier in very light terms about that growing finger business, the pixie dust, and that is something that's clearly nonsense, and you hope that people will not believe it. But when it comes to things like climate, there are people spouting essentially lies on the internet and places like that, and if you're not a climate scientist, you might get confused by this. I mean, you also say in your book that sometimes the science gets lost, really, in the maelstrom.
It does. It's quite easy to get lost. And I think also it's quite easy to get there as sort of like just one other doomsday scenario that people talk about all the time. And what I really wanted to do in the book was explain the science, but I didn't want to get on the soapbox. There's nothing worse than being preached to. I wanted to sort of give fun examples of loony characters and really exciting stuff looking at ice and tree rings and corals and just explain how we understand what's going on today.
Chris, what do you think is fueling climate change denial?
Yeah, that's an interesting one. I don't really know, to be perfectly honest. I mean, there's always an element of scepticism, and in science, that's healthy. I think there's a danger, though, that when you ignore the wealth of the evidence and then you say the exact opposite just to be dogmatic or something, and that's dangerous, and they become more and more entrenched as a result. I think the real problem of a risk with it is that these views, these opposing views have become so vocal for so long. It's delayed so much that we could have done in the last decade. It's gut-wrenching looking back at it and thinking, oh, if only we'd started earlier. And that's the problem. That's the real risk we run, is that we've got the technology, we can do something about it, but we need to do it sooner rather than later. And because these guys have held on for so long, there's a very real risk that people are going to suddenly go from, oh, it's all okay, to suddenly, oh, there's nothing we could do about it, so let's just carry on partying, and, you know, the band's still playing while the ship's going down. And we don't want that. So we need to start thinking positively, but actually have a real sense of leadership and actually do something about it.
It must be quite exhausting, though, to kind of have to keep having those discussions, those conversations. I mean, Alok used the phrase climate change denier. I think Realzat did earlier on, and I'm not very keen on the denier phrase, because it's too close to Holocaust denier, which is so loaded.
It's very emotive, isn't it?
And anyway, debate within science is good, and there will be parts of the climate science debate that are going to be, you know, there are going to be conflicting views, and that's all okay. So I personally prefer kind of skeptic. But anyway, the argument with the skeptic has been pretty much the same over the last sort of 10 years. It must be exhausting as a scientist to have to keep saying that.
Yeah, that's very true. But what you find is that there's not many scientists who are saying this. It's more and more certain business people or other people with interested groups who are actually making these cases. And I think actually we're starting to detect now, scientists are starting to catch on a little bit. It's a bit like some of these arguments with creationism. You don't engage with them so much on the specifics of the science, because it's out there, people can find that information. And as soon as you start engaging with them on these sort of minor details, which are generally, that's what they're picking at, they're cherry picking, you sort of get bogged down and you immediately imply that there's actually a big debate to be had. Whereas in reality, what we're starting to do now, I think, more is step back and say, look, we have a moral obligation. This is what this will mean for you and your grandchildren. I think that's another big thing, is over the last few years, I think one of the reasons why there's a lot of public interest in this is that we're starting to see some big shifts, ones which we've not seen for a few millennia. And whereas before it was some sort of abstract term that these changes would happen to your grandchildren, suddenly we're going to see these changes in our lives and our children's lives. And I think that's put a whole different level of urgency in the debate, really, which is good in some respects.
I think we should end on a good note. I mean, the end of your book does have some positive things to say, is that there is time to do stuff about this. So it's not all doom and gloom, hopefully.
No. Fingers crossed. Razor blades aren't provided.
Fingers crossed. Well, you can read all of that in the book. Well, let's wrap all this up now. You can head to blogs.guardian.co.uk/science for links to all of the stories we've discussed. And if there's something you're desperate to tell us, post a comment on our Facebook wall. My thanks to James Randerson, Realzat Butt, and our special guest, Chris Turney. His book, Ice, Mud and Blood, Lessons from Climate's Past, is out now. Science Weekly was produced this week by Kate Taylor. I'm Alok Jha. Thanks for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.